Hello, everyone, and welcome to Game Devastation. This is the Video Game Development Podcast. I'm your host, Frost, and I'm joined today by the illustrious Austin Ivansmith. How you doing, man?
I am doing quite well, thank you. How are you?
I'm dandy. So just as a background, you and I have worked together, sort of.
Kind of. In the same building, not on the same thing.
Right. We did not work on the same project, but we worked at the same company, which was WayForward Technologies. And can you tell me, what do you do there exactly?
At WayForward, I am a director. Basically, I oversee the creative development of projects at the company. I work directly under the creative director. So, you know, at other companies where there might only be one or two projects going on at a time, the creative director will be, you know, very hands-on with those projects. But we generally tend to have like between seven or eight projects going on at once. And so we like to have a director dedicated to each project. So we, you know, see the day-to-day, talk to the publisher, you know, just see the game from beginning to end, usually write the GDD and handle the game design document and handle all that stuff. So yeah, we're overseeing all the creative aspects as an extension of the creative director and reporting to the creative director and the executive producer of the company.
Okay. So can you talk to me a little bit about the titles that you've worked on in the past couple? You've been there for like 6 years, right?
Yeah, 6 years this March.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So, grats. And what have you done while there in the 6 year tenure that you've been working as a director?
Well, when I started, I came over in March, and they had a director who had recently left, and they needed someone to take over a project. And I had some experience managing projects and doing level design at previous companies, and so I did Galactic Tazball, which was a title that not many people saw. It's really sad too, because it didn't come out until like 12 months after we finished the game, or like 12 months or more. And it's just like all of a sudden it's on the store shelves. It's like, oh, hey, there it is. And at the Toys R Us in town, they had like 8 copies just sitting there, and they were still $20, you know? And it's like, oh, and it was for DS. So they're still $20. And it's like, they've been there forever. And we just went this weekend, and we're missing just a bunch of DS titles. They cleared house, I guess, and they had no more. And that was very, very sad. But yeah, because they hadn't hit the bargain bin yet. It was like, yeah, $20, man. Quality title. But no, it was actually, that was a lot of fun. It was a top-down game. Mostly all the characters were 3D. WayForward is traditionally known as a 2D animated pixel art, side-scrolling type place, and Taz was a 3D model game, and I had background in 3D modeling, so I was a perfect fit to oversee the project. And we did it in a really quick timeline, and right as we were developing it, WB came to us and said, oh, we have this new show coming out called The Looney Tunes Show, and they were rebranding the characters, giving them a whole new look, and they said, hey, can you change the art for your game? I'm like, oh yeah, sure. So we updated the art for the game, made it look a little bit more like the show, and then the show got delayed multiple times. Yeah. And so the game got delayed with it until finally the game came out, and then the show came out right after. So it was really kind of awkward, but that was the first title. It was pretty fun. It was actually two parts. There was like an overworld where you use like a trackball on the bottom screen, on the touch screen, and then you make Taz like sort of move around based on trackball movement. And I remember it was really funny. Matt Bozon, our creative director, said, yeah, we're going to do this thing they're doing in this game called Rizoad, which is Wizard of Oz. And it's like, and since it's never going to come to America, we can just use this trackball system. And it came to America. There was actually an advertisement for Wizard of Oz, like on the same page that like Taz or another game of ours was being featured on a Nintendo Power, which is really funny. But yeah, and then there's this underground part, which is kind of like an Incredible Machine kind of thing. So cool. Yeah, it's neat. Anyway, that was my first game. And then I did some level design on Despicable Me, you know, Mini Mayhem, which is, you know, sounds like nothing, but it sold like, I guess, 200,000 units for the publisher or something, because like Despicable Me took off, so it was like my top selling game at the time. Nice. In my career, which is kind of funny. And then after that, I directed Thor God of Thunder, which was pretty freaking rad. It was a great experience. And then what came after that? Was that Thor? Oh, then Happy Feet 2. Happy Feet 2, which had tied in with the movie, which, you know, it was like, oh, kids movie or whatever, but it was a pretty fun experience too. Anyway, because the team, you know, really cared about the game, and we got Oza Motley to do all the music in the game.
That's so awesome.
They did every single track.
And not to interrupt your list of awesomeness that you have here, but
interrupt away, please. It's your show.
Well, so how difficult is it? Like, I think you probably don't spend your weekends watching Happy Feet or anything related to it. How difficult is it to come up with a gaming experience that is fun for an IP that maybe isn't your favorite thing in the world?
I don't think it's that hard, because you just think of a game that you love to play and try to incorporate that fun into a game. Like, if you focus too much on, oh, it's an IP that, you know, doesn't really fit in with my tastes as, you know, an adult with, you know, whatever my tastes are. And then you just sort of, give wrongly attribute both context and gameplay. You know what I mean? So it's like, oh, well, this is a kid's game, therefore it needs to have these kiddie elements, and this is an adult game, therefore it has to have these adult things. Whereas adults play Mario games all the time, and, you know, kids play Minecraft. Or, you know, there's complicated elements within that game that you wouldn't think kids could grasp, just in terms of, like, you know, not like, yeah, whatever. Anyway, it's like, Boldy was just, our CEO was just here saying, like, oh yeah, my 5-year-old playing, you know, Minecraft. And you're like, how the heck can a 5-year-old play Minecraft? You know, like, I don't know. Some adults can't even program their VCRs. VCRs. What's a VCR? You're old.
What? Yeah, anyway. I was gonna say. What? Explain to me this VCR concept you just brought up.
I meant computer and modem. Wait, no, no. But I don't think it's that hard, because, you know, especially there's a lot of games that are fun for everyone. Like for me, when I play like a Mario game or a Zelda or a Lego game, because at the time Happy Feet, that was like 2011, and I'd been just played like the Lego Star Wars and Lego Indiana Jones, and it was like, well, how do we make a game that's, you know, good for kids but still a challenge? And I thought those were a good example where, you know, when I first heard that the game, like, oh yeah, you can't die. There's no like major fail state. You just keep going. And I was like, what? That's stupid. That makes no sense. And then I played it. I'm like, oh, this is so enjoyable. I like it. And I still tried not to die. So there was still plenty to enjoy about it. Yeah. And, you know, that was sort of where I pulled from for the starters. And then, you know, it had to involve dancing, and I'm not a dancer. But, you know, that didn't stop me from having to dance in front of animators to show what kind of moves the character should do.
Good old reference video.
Luckily, no one videotaped it. So,
or even digitally recorded it, right?
Luckily, no one took out a camera and recorded it to a video file. You know what? In my defense,
yeah,
we still use words like rewind.
We do.
And rewind, true. And I've been talking about this recently. It's like rewind makes no sense on its own. You have to understand what winding is. But yeah, I'm. Wow, it's a Sunday. I'm tired.
Yeah, no, hey, it's all good, man. I understand.
Really quickly, so Happy Feet 2. And to your point, yeah, it's a kid's game. And at the time, everyone else at the company was working on things that were cooler. We were doing Silent Hill. We were doing, I think Batman Brave and the Bold was either being worked on or wrapped up. It might have been wrapped up at the time. Blood Rain was being worked on. There was a version of Centipede being worked on. There's all these games that were, you know, had, you know, there were much more interesting projects. And I had the team that was like with Happy Feet. But, you know, we had a lot of fun. Everyone put a lot of heart into it, and we had fun developing it. So it was it was overall a good experience. After that, I went on to Mighty Switch Force. I helped with a little design, ended up assistant directing the project. And then after that was DuckTales. Remastered, and don't do that.
I'm sorry, then, dude. I can't not do it when I hear the word.
And then while working on DuckTales, did Mighty Switch Force HD. Then DuckTales wrapped up, and I've done a couple other things since then. Nothing that got much acclaim, but yeah. And now I'm the associate director on Shantae Half Genie Hero, which was our Kickstarter.
Can you talk to me a bit about what a director does exactly at WayForward?
Well, it varies from director to director and project to project, but generally speaking, we mostly start off with we're involved in the pitch process. So when a game is being pitched, when a publisher comes to us and says, hey, you know, we're going to be doing, you know, DuckTales, for example, or, you know, Double Dragon, what are your ideas? And then we're usually in a room when we hear the news and what games are coming up, and we bounce ideas off each other and say, oh, man, it'd be cool if this was, you know, like this, it was like this. And then someone is assigned to write a pitch document for it. It's usually like a 1 to 2 page document. Sometimes we do a PowerPoint presentation, put in some concept art, you know, try to sell the publisher on these are our ideas, and they come back to us with a yes or no. And then usually the person who pitches it, you know, is usually has the most free time, which also means that they're the most free up to work on a project next. So they're generally the person that ends up directing the project. And then you write the game design document, you plan out, you know, the scope of the game, all the enemies, all the characters, the playable characters, bosses, you know, write all that up fairly early on, hopefully. You know, sometimes it goes a little longer than you want it to. And then, you know, oversee the development of that game while it's happening. And then usually we on a weekly basis, usually in a call with the publisher, you know, you're a direct line of contact. You work closely with a producer or a project manager on your project who plans out the schedule and you know, the scheduling of the assets and you know, the production sheets and the meetings and stuff like that. But, you know, usually just every week, just playing the game, checking on progress, making sure, you know, everyone has the designs they need, checking on the art, and then just all the way up through testing and submitting. You know, you're right there in the trenches with the team playing the game, sometimes fixing stuff. Like on Happy Feet, like I said, Oza Motley made all the songs, but it was on a, you know, Nintendo DS cartridge, and which is very low space, and we didn't have a MP3 or OGG compressor at the time, so everything had to be WAV files. But the songs were so big that they wouldn't fit, so I actually had to go in myself and chop up all the songs and concatenate them. So it basically took someone had a motorcycle go out their window.
So yeah, the studio, I'm putting my finger quotes up, the studio that I have is my house. And so there's
I'm on the corner. I came to the office today because otherwise you'd hear my kids screaming in the background.
See, you're doing it the professional way. Yeah, I'm doing it the professional way.
Everything I do is the professional way. So you're welcome. Done.
Yeah.
Except for when I call out motorcycles, I hear. But yeah. So like, I have to get my hands dirty a lot, and do those kinds of things. I was jumping on DuckTales and doing some programming and scripting at the very end, and you know, cleaning up art on Thor. We had a font that was broken. Like there was just the letter capital B just wouldn't work. But I found that if I went to the font file and I added a new character, like ampersand, which we never used anywhere, but I used ampersand, but I used the symbol of capital B for it, it didn't crash. So I went through like this, the text file, which there was no find and replace, and I had to go through and change all the capital Bs in like some XML sheet and just, you know, go through and like make sure that all the capital Bs were changed to ampersands so they actually displayed correctly. So if you read the script, it wouldn't make any sense at all. I mean, just stuff like that. You're just, you know, really, I don't know, just working. But yeah, that's basically
what it. Is.
That's what it is. I think. But yeah, sometimes we have guys who are like more art directors. They had like an art director background. They might have had like a designer oversee the design, and they were more focused on the art kind of aspect. And sometimes we had art directors come on to projects. For Batman Brave and the Bold, Mark Gomez was the art director on that. He was also the art director on A Boy and His Blob, but he also directed games by himself as well. So yeah.
Gotcha. A question I wanted to ask about when you, let's say that your project gets greenlit, right? You now have a project of your own. What is the first step in development?
The first step, usually the game design document. Once it's greenlit, it's starting to write the game design document, and it's sometimes it's a scope. You do a scope document, because generally speaking, we tend to work on short enough time frames that we can't design everything up front. So usually you write the game design document in tandem with a lead programmer setting up the project from a programming standpoint, and then getting a prototype of the game working, which is the groundwork for the entire game. So I think that's it. It's different from project to project, but that's generally, like, those two things happen concurrently, and then, you know, people start getting rolled onto the project. Concept art also. So if there's concept design for environments, or there's character design, those are usually happening while you're writing the GDD and while a programmer is setting up an environment using just test objects.
Gotcha. The review process. You were talking about this earlier, and while I was at WayForward, this was definitely a part of the team making a better product. What is that like? Can you describe the review process on a weekly basis? What is it that you're looking for? How do you track things? How do you change things? Like, what is that like?
It all changes with the size of a project. When I'm on something small, like a Happy Feet, where there's only, eight other developers, and they're just in the room with you. You can just play it and shout it across the room, because, you're still early enough that there isn't a bug base, that there's no testers, testing the game officially. And so you're just looking at things. Although on Happy Feet, every Friday at, I think, 4 p.m., we would all get together and play the game as a group and talk about it. Because, that the environment artists sat in a different area and the animators were in a different area. So the whole team would come together and we would play the game. And then anyone, if they saw something or had an idea, it was a really good time to speak up and for everyone to see the game running at the same time. Because a lot of times artists, for some reason, some of them tend to not like play the game too much, or they tend not to, see other parts of the game. They just see the level they're working on. So when they see a boss in action, when they see, a bunch of other components, it really opens their eyes to, like, oh my gosh, there's so much game here, and it can be really fun. You get a really great group environment of just everyone having fun playing the game. Or if anyone has an idea, that anyone can throw out an idea and it can be written down, cataloged, or and addressed right away, because you never know who's going to have a really cool gameplay idea. Especially the bosses in Thor, we did that a lot, where a lot of people throwing out like a lot of what ifs. What if he attacked like this? What if he attacked like this? What if we changed this? So our bosses had a weekly iteration, and it really paid off in the end.
Yeah, that's cool. I think I've been at a few places now, and I can say that there's some spots where there are developers that don't really appreciate other departments' thoughts and feedback on stuff, and never really made sense to me. Because the thing about it is, if you're into design, you're into games. And if you're into games, you can have opinions on design. So I like the fact that other people can kind of chime in and say, even if you're an artist, or you're in QA, or you're in, you're a programmer or something like that, you can throw out ideas. Because a lot of times there are things that, even if you're a designer working on the project, you're so close to it that you don't even think outside the realm of what you're kind of working on anyway, So that's cool.
Yeah, being so close to it's a really great example, because that tends to happen a lot. And then also, I mean, I like the Ratatouille phrasing of a great chef. Not everyone can be a great chef, but a great chef can a great chef can come from anywhere, and that, like, a great idea can come from anyone if they're recognizing it in the moment. And then I read something one time on Gama Sutra, I think at Blizzard, they're just talking about, people, a lot of people want to work in games. Like, I want to work in games, I have ideas. And it's like, well, everyone has ideas, but when you want to become a designer, it's not just to design your ideas. Sometimes it's really important to design someone else's idea. And that's, a part of being a designer. And that's a part of, what we do as directors too. Because if someone comes to us and says, here's the parameters of what the game needs to be, they're giving you their idea. So you're trying to make their game for them. They don't just say, I want a game. What do you think it should be? Sometimes right. It happens, but not always.
Yeah. I think, that is a difficult thing to learn for some people when they're first coming into the industry as well, because they come in and they think, like, the world is my oyster and I can't wait to come up with all these crazy ideas and put them in the game. But not only is it maybe not the project that you're working on that is yours, you're working on a project perhaps, but you also have to understand how to put that in game. Because there's a lot of people that are like, okay, imagine if we had this guy and he can shoot like a rocket and it blows up the moon, and then the moon comes down and blows up half the town. You're like, well, that's cool, but Can you actually do that?
Yeah. How are we going to fit into VRAM? What's VRAM?
What?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's always an interesting thing to learn. But cool. That review process sounds neato, and I can attest that it was neato when I was there. So you were just talking about this. I mean, the list that you have, it has a smorgasbord of customers. Can you talk about any kind of crazy publisher experiences that you've had that won't get you in too much trouble or anything like that?
I don't know. No, I mean, if it was a crazy experience, I probably can't talk about it, but I haven't had that many crazy experiences, so nothing's coming to mind. Mostly everything's been great. I hear a lot of horror stories, and I had some horror stories from previous companies I worked for that, you know, I still don't feel comfortable talking about. But the thing that kind of blows my mind is the amount of talent and the amount of, like, I guess professionalism that I've seen from the companies we've worked with. Because like we worked with WB and Jeff Knockbauer at WB and Scott Warr, like those guys were incredible. And Jeff Knockbauer is doing iDARP now.
That game looks awesome.
Yeah, it really does. You know, and it's just like, you know, you get an email from them and they're like, hey, like this thing isn't working. Why isn't this working? And you explain it and they go, okay, good to know. And it's like, oh, you're rational. You understand. Like, that's cool. I've heard horror stories where that kind of thing doesn't happen. You know, working with Capcom and Disney on DuckTales, you know, they would say like, hey, can we do this thing? And we're just like, well, no, we can't for this reason. And they're like, okay, thanks for letting us know. You know, so I think the biggest thing was that there were people at Disney that didn't understand that we were 2D animating the game and what that meant, that like every single frame was hand drawn. And so, you know, we needed to put eye blinks on all the characters. Like that's a requirement for all the Disney characters, that they can't look like they're, you know, these static characters without eyelids, you know, these like freaky alien looking things. So we have to make, you know, give them a human element and have them blink their eyes. But each animation where there's character eyes has the eye blinks have to be hand drawn. Whereas in 3D, you know, you just model 3D eyelids and they just like, you know, they can come up and down on their own separate animation at any time within any animation.
Right.
We can't do that in 2D. Their eyes are in a different spot, you know, every single animation. But, and it was kind of hard, you know, having our producer explain that to his bosses, because, you know, it's different. Like, I don't think they've done many 2D hand-drawn games in a long time. There's been a lot of 3D going on recently. So you kind of take for granted the technology and the ease of some things that come from that.
Yeah, most definitely. So yeah. I've actually got a question that kind of relates to that. You guys are known for doing side scroller games. I mean, that seems to be the bread and butter, and you're really good at it. Can you talk about when you're coming up with a project, like even DuckTales, do you want to innovate much on that, or are you sticking to the old school sensibilities? Cause I know something like Double Dragon, when you guys worked on that, it was pretty close to the original, but then some people were saying like, well, it doesn't feel as good as other side scrollers. And it was because you're matching the control almost exactly. Right. So how hard is that decision-making process for you guys to say like, well, we need to innovate the side scroller genre, or we need to kind of stick with the old school way that has worked tried and true for a long time?
It's easy to look at our library and say, you know, oh, they just did side scroller and then blank, you know, whatever. But from year to year, we have different motivations for what we want to do with the side scrollers. So it does vary from project to project, you know, and it varies from like what you're seeing come out from other companies. You know, when we play someone else's version of a side scroller, and the character jump doesn't feel right, and you know, the basic mobility just doesn't feel right, but they're trying to introduce these other elements. It's the kind of thing that has made us in conversation just say, like, oh man, like someone just needs to show them how solid, you know, jump physics and solid, you know, navigation works. And, you know, that's the core. We get that in. And I think, you know, Double Dragon might have been an example of that. You get a lot of the side-scrolling fighting games, and they just lost a lot of the characters. So it's an experiment. It's, you say it at the beginning, like, well, let's try this, because one of the neat things about that genre was the, you know, the Z, you know, interpenetrating. Like when you're playing Double Dragon and you're walking up through a character, you know, your 3D model doesn't, you know, blend with them. You draw in front of them like they're 2D, and then you pop right behind them the moment you're behind them.
Right.
So it's kind of a neat little trick we did, and that was sort of like, you know, we did that intentionally. It's like, we want to copy. We want to do what the NES, what the Super Nintendo did right, and then build from there. Sometimes you don't have time to build from there, and sometimes it's just, this is what we like. After a game's out, you know, you might see a couple comments, you know, in comment sections or from fans or from reviews that said like, oh, well, these were my expectations for where they could take it. But, you know, the person in charge of the game, the director or the publisher, or the company as a whole, you know, those might not match with our directives. Like we wanted to try just a couple things, and this is what we as creators wanted to do with the project. And then we did that. You know, with Mighty Switch Force, it was, we wanted a short game that you could speed run in 20 to 30 minutes when you knew what you're doing. It's like, I want to go sit down and play Switch Force from front to back. And you play it for 20 to 30 minutes. And people said afterwards, oh man, the game was so short. And we said, yep, that's what we set out to do. So we as creators, that was our intent. That was what we wanted to create. And so, you know, we do that with the side-scrollers from time to time. For DuckTales, that was a big challenge. We knew early on that there was an expectation of, you know, making a game that felt a lot like the original and didn't do wrong by it. You know, because I feel like I've played games that have been, you know, remakes or tried to capture the spirit of something, but just felt really weird. The jump physics had too much acceleration, or, you know, you go off a ledge, you like slowly sort of, you know, with like your capsule collision would slide off a corner of a ledge, you know, that kind of stuff can get really kind of frustrating. But yeah, it varies from project to project because of just how the industry changes. But, you know, all in all, we try to innovate, you know, as much as we can within the realms of like what we think will be cool for the product, but then also what, you know, a publisher is going to allow, and, you know, and a licensor is going to allow. You know, there's things we couldn't do in Thor because Marvel said, no, Thor won't do that. You know, Loki can't do that, et cetera. So, you know, there's things that, you know, you have parameters that you have to stay within. Sometimes it's not up to you.
Right. So talking about the old school blend into newer stuff, maybe this will relate. What are your favorite games, and what do you kind of find motivation from when you're doing design stuff?
For me, when I'm thinking about design, the weirdest thing for me is I'm big into animation, and I'm big into mobility and like movie choreography. So like I like thinking about gymnastics or thinking about fight choreography or thinking about fluidity and motion. So when I first imagine a game, the first thing I picture is how a character is going to be moving around the room and, you know, sort of bouncing around the walls and bouncing around the characters and like what that core is going to be. That's just how my brain's always been from like an animation background. So it completely fights, you know, with like, cause I mean, I tend to get more inspiration from music than I do from games, you know, cause like I'll play games and like, I like that game for what that game is. And I have fun playing that game. But when I listen to music, I visualize like what game would fit around what I'm hearing, what energy, you know, what theme is happening right now. So that's more where my brain goes, which is kind of, you know, weird. But yeah, for me, some of my favorite games, for me to this day, I think Metal Gear Solid on the PlayStation is just up there for me. There's just so much about the game that is just thematically, it's just thematically gorgeous. And it takes place in the snow, and I really like the snow. So it's sort of, that's sort of an interesting one for me. But, you know, it was really pushing boundaries at the time. And
that was an epic game for the time period.
Like it was up there.
I remember I rented that game from Blockbuster Video, if I'm going to date myself.
And that's what this podcast is. We're just dating ourselves a bunch.
Yeah, that's. And I remember renting it, and I just didn't stop, and I had to immediately go back and then rent it more because I couldn't beat it in the time that I had rented it. But I was like, I can't not see what happens here, and this is too crazy. But the only part of that game, by the way, that really just made me want to flip a desk was the backtracking that you had to do all right. the way back to the end. I was like, come on, guys. Like, I didn't know if that was a directive from someone to be like, well, we need to make it a little bit longer. Go all the way to the beginning and then get your ass back to the end.
Well, I mean, you know, you look at what Kojima's done these days and you got to figure it. Yeah, it's might have been some wild idea he had. Yeah, go get this key card and sit in the lava area for a while. Well, I tried using a Game Shark to get Big Boss mode or, you know, the Big Boss ending or whatever your descriptor is at the end.
Yeah.
You know, your level, Big Boss. And you have to do it in under like 3 hours or something like that. And so I used a Game Shark code to give me the box to like jump to the third section. And I still couldn't do it because it took me too long to get the key cards heated up and cooled down to get through that one section, which is really funny to me. But it was just it was probably the most epic game for its time that also just felt like an amazing twist on a story, you know, because, and they did a great job with it, you know, in the packaging and in the presentation of it too. Cause you know, when you look, when you're thumbing through the manual and like, oh, look at all these guys, you know, Liquid Snake, Decoy Octopus, Vulcan Raven. And it doesn't even dawn on you that, you know, when I think Harold Miller, whoever dies, it's like, oh, that was Decoy Octopus. Like that's such a, you know, such a nice little twist. Of course they kind of ruined it in the American packaging where it didn't list an actor for Master Miller.
Right.
And you're like, that sounds a lot like, you know, Leonardo from Turtles, and so does Liquid Snake, and it's like maybe it's the same guy, and then it turns out it's the same guy. There's so many good twists, you know. It's a bit long, and I couldn't make it through the GameCube version, but you know, it was, there's like neat little storytelling features, and like just there's a lot going on there. So for me, like when I think about amazing games, it's like that Super Mario World, and probably, I don't know, Peggle.
Random.
Sorry.
Why Peggle?
Peggle is a game that you can hand to me and I will just play it from start to back. I will start it over. Actually, Puzzle Fighter 2. I like puzzle games. I like things that have some physics, and I'm not talking about the new Peggle with the, you know, in-app purchase junk. I'm talking about like, you know, oh, I got Peggle on my PC and I played through all the levels. I'm like, that was pretty fun. Like, hey, it's on DS. I'll play that. And I play through all the levels. Then I get it on my phone and I'm literally playing it in a hospital room waiting for my wife to go into labor. And I'm just playing it. She's like, are you playing that game? I'm like, yeah, I'm playing the game. It's, you know, it's fun. It's taking up my time. And then she's like, all right, well, let's have the baby. I'm like, okay, cool. Like, I'm not like, sorry, baby, I'm busy playing Peggle. But, you know, it's just I can't put it down when I'm actually... Well, I can't put it down, but I don't like to. I enjoy playing it. I'm saying all the wrong things.
I was at a wedding not too long ago, and they played that. Immediately, I just thought of Peggle, and I'm like, man, this is really lame. That's what, you know. This is a fantastic song.
When you think about it, it's a game that does everything right because it's simple, it's cute. It's got a nice little mechanic. It's got the right amount of randomness for us, you know, randomly assigning where the orange pegs are. It has a great presentation. So when you're, you know, about to get that last peg and the camera zooms in, it's got a great sensation. And that's what I think a lot of games miss, especially, you know, from like some indie developers now where it's like, oh, you know, you're doing some neat concepts, but there's an element of polish and presentation that just really separates the wheat from the chaff. And that's the thing that's always done it for me with Peggle is that it's enjoyable. So,
all right.
And that's why it would be on my top 10 list. I've got a pinball game on there too. I've got Earthshaker because it's just like pinball is such an overlooked, you know, element to our video game history. But
and that
yeah.
certainly has pinball elements to it. So
It does. I like those. We had a pachinko machine in my basement as a kid, and God knows why we had it, because no one played it. Just something my dad wanted probably, but I wanted to play it every time I saw it. I'm like, that looks so cool, and whenever I have the opportunity to do something that's physics based like that, I just love it. Mario Sunshine had something like that, and it's like I wanted to just go into those levels and do that kind of thing all the time.
Gotcha.
I like physics. They're fun.
Yeah, no, definitely. So another thing that I am looking to do more and more on this podcast is for people that are looking to get into the industry. I wanted to get advice from the people that have been in it for a while. So do you have any advice for people that are trying to get in the industry as a game designer or an artist or anything like that?
The best advice that I could probably give to someone is if there is a company in your area, try to get an internship with them. I got an internship at a place no one had heard of, but I ended up meeting people that helped me get jobs at many places down the road. At every single video game company in the world, there will always be people that have worked on some project you have heard of and have either worked with someone they respect. They'll have some wealth of knowledge, because even on the worst games, you know, I've worked on some really bad video games at previous companies, and there was some really great talent and some really smart people. And there's just like circumstances you can't understand why a bad game's made until you're working on one. You're like, man, so this is how a bad game's made. This kind of sucks, but there's still lots of talent there. And
let me interrupt you there. Why are bad games made?
There can be a number of reasons. Sometimes it's that there's one person with too much power who just has some really, really bad ideas and just doesn't understand how games are made. It can be really bad, or they you know, put their own personal things before professional things. I've seen that on projects where it's like they cared more about getting their idea in the game than the art director saying like that won't work.
Right. Yeah.
And then it just things didn't work, or you know, just they put their own personal stuff ahead and they create like a bad work environment, and then you know they can't talk to the team, and they just, you know, butt heads. There's I've seen some weird stuff, but sometimes it's, you know, just like I worked at an arcade game company, and it's just you had a couple people that, you know, they just came in from nowhere and they're just like, yeah, make this for us, and they didn't know what a game was, and they're just hard to please, you know. We eventually had to just like not make something for them, where it's just like, yeah, we just stopped talking to them. They don't understand, you know, what a game is. So there's all kinds of weird stuff. But yeah, generally, sometimes I think the biggest factor is just time, because I think that if you see a bad game and it just feels like it was rushed, sometimes it just is. You know, you look at Blizzard, and they take forever on games because they're, you know, tuning and tweaking and changing, and sometimes games just they have to get released. You know, there's people that it's just like someone came to us one time. They're like, oh, we want MotorStorm, but we want it with twice the levels in, you know, 8 months. And it's like, that's kind of impossible. So you have to talk them down and then just say like, you know, we can do this much in this time. And, you know, if we had more time, we could have polished it more and made it a much better game. But sometimes it's just like, well, no, we think it's good enough. We're going to release it. So.
Right. And that is for people listening, to answer that question of, you know, why do bad games get made? Sometimes publishers will just come in saying, you know, I have a license for this thing. It needs to be done in this amount of time. Maybe a company got a movie license or a, you know, TV show license or something along those lines, and they need it out because the season of that show is coming up or this movie is coming up, and they don't have the time to get to it. Your example of Blizzard is a great one because they have the capability and the means to iterate a lot. They don't have to worry about budget, you know, and you have World of Warcraft funding a lot of your company and other mega successful games. It allows you to kind of say like, okay, we're not rushing this out. We're gonna take our time and make this as awesome as we possibly can. And something else to throw out though, even that sometimes you can put out a bad game. And I'm not advocating that Blizzard does. I'm saying that if you have infinite time and infinite money, that's not always a good recipe for a game either. Sometimes
that's true. And to go back to a second to Blizzard is arguably the reason they are given the opportunity to not have to worry about money is because they worked with that mentality early on, and that they said the quality of this matters most. And so we need to make the best game possible. And that they did that with StarCraft, that they did that with Warcraft and Warcraft 2, that they're like, we're going to make the best possible game we can, you know, for the late 90s. And, you know, that's what gained them the following that they ended up getting to allow them to make the games that they want to make.
Absolutely.
It's kind of interesting. It's hard to get to that point, though. You know, it takes a lot of skill. It doesn't happen without a lot of talent and a lot of capability and a little bit of luck. So, you know, you can have that skill and that capability and still never really, you know, have it work out. But you can't just have luck and then just not, and luck alone won't give it to you. You still need the capability and skill.
No, so. Absolutely.
But going back to getting a job in the industry is, yes. I really think that, you know, for example, I was talking to some people I was getting coffee at Starbucks, wearing a video game shirt. You strike up a conversation and someone says, oh yeah, you know, my boyfriend or my girlfriend or who, you know, my sister, my brother, they're trying to get an internship at Blizzard. And I say, well, you know, if that doesn't work out, they can get an internship with us or they can get an internship, you know, at another place, you know, within a 30-mile radius, because, you know, you can get a lot of experience, a lot of useful experience there, and meet a lot of people and learn things that you would never know are important things to learn. So that's what I would say. Go, even going with a no-name place, there's still a lot of places to go after that. But also, you know, if you're too young to get a job or too young to, you know, get an internship, just make games. Like if you say, I want to design games, you should be designing games. You should actually be developing games. Like if you said, well, I want to be an artist someday, but I'm never going to pick up a piece of paper or a pencil and draw or paint until I go to start art college, it doesn't work that way. You know, design and game development is much the same way. There's plenty of tools out in this world to make your own games or design board games. There is you can't understate how important, you know, and how much overlap there is between designing a board game and designing a real game. You know, just one's on paper and one's, you know, digital. There's so much overlap. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, and speaking of those tools, you know, maybe there are people out there that don't know where they can kind of get started. Hold on a sec, I'm gonna let this dude go by. It's rocking really loud music. Quality. If I were to get started in the industry and I wanted to start designing games, you know, maybe I can't get a job somewhere, maybe I'm too young. How do I do that? Like, what tools can I use to create games?
The one I recommend the most is Game Maker. I've developed games in it. It's got years of development behind it and a really good team that's supporting it right now. I really like it. If you've never programmed before, it's got really good fundamentals. It's even got a store for you can download someone else's you know, setup for physics and just pop in your own characters and animations. Or Unity, you know, Unity has some free stuff too, and you can do more 3D stuff in that. So if you want to do 2D side scroller or, you know, top down RPG style game, I would highly recommend Game Maker. And if you want to do something more 3D, I'd highly recommend Unity. There's other things out there as well to get you started on an even more basic level. There's like Construct and Macromedia Fusion. There are things like that. Is that Macromedia? Something like that. Multimedia Fusion is what it's called. So there's things where multiple people make lots of games out there. But, you know, there's games getting published in Game Maker on, you know, PlayStation, Luftrausser, Nuclear Throne, and Gunpoint, and Hyper Light Drifter. You know, those are all made in Game Maker. I personally like working with it. But yeah, everything's different. So just a lot of these things are free too to try out. So there's a not to.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of tools, what does WayForward use for technology to make games?
It varies from project to project. On DS and 3DS, we had our own code that was built up for DS and Game Boy Advance. For 3DS, we used a little bit of that and another engine that was proprietary. For DuckTales, we had our own engine that was built off of the Blood Rain engine. which was an extension of, and Double Dragon Neon was built in that same engine, and it was all an extension of, yeah, Blood Rain and A Boy and His Blob, like our 2D side-scrolling stuff. But we also have done stuff in Unity. You know, we've done a couple of Unity projects. We did, what is it, that Silent Hill Book of Memories, we did that in Infernal Engine. You know, we've done things in multiple engines all over the place, but most recently, if we're doing like a we want performance is a top thing for us, game performance, and so we built our own engine that goes, you know, it goes 60 frames a second, and it's 6 frames a second, it's 1080p. So DuckTales runs at 1080p 60 frames a second on the Wii U, Xbox 360 and PS3. So you know, for us, performance is key, and graphics are key. And so we find that making your own engine kind of gives you the most freedom for that. There's less overhead compared to something like a Unity or an Unreal.
Gotcha. So this is the part of the show where I ask community questions. So I put some stuff out on Twitter, asked some people what their thoughts were. We got a few questions. One of which you kind of already answered, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
Please do. It was just fun. I felt like I had to answer it.
This was, why the hell couldn't I skip the dialogue in DuckTales? It's a good remake, though.
So, that you hinted at that earlier in our talk about being too close to something. So a little bit of that is DuckTales. We were tasked with, you know, remaking the NES game. And so it was, okay, well, in the NES game, you know, you've got Webby in a level, you've got Dewey in a level, just, you know, sort of in the levels. And originally that was the plan, that you just, you know, run across the characters, you'd see them. And when we hit about Vertical Slice or got, you know, a little further into development, Disney came back and said, hey, so we've talked about getting the cast to, you know, be voices for your game. What do you think of that? And it was like, yeah, you know, like, you don't say no to that. So it went from just having a couple lines, a couple interactions to, well, we've got full cast. We should probably have, you know, some intros and outros and just really like play up and, you know, the DuckTales feel like, well, how do we really just make this, you know, the best thing it can be as a DuckTales experience, not just we were remaking the NES game. This was, you know, the first DuckTales branded item, if not just a game, but like thing since the 90s. It's been a long time. So we really felt we had to, you know, pay as much respect to fans of the show as fans of the game. So we wrote a very thorough script that, you know, Disney even said is like, you know, this was the most like on true to brand script they had received in a long time, which is, you know, pretty neat. It was very, very, we were very, very honored to be told that. So, you know, there you have it. We wrote the script. We wrote that in probably the summer before. Dialogue was happening in like December and January and February. And then, you know, it took some time to get the dialogue, you know, cut up and processed. And then that all came together around, you know, March or April. And then, you know, everyone is seeing the game in June at E3. And that build had been made in May. So there'd only been a little time where all the script and dialogue had actually gone into the game for us to actually say, like, oh, man, like, some of this is a bit long. And so we cut a lot of lines out of that for sections where it was a bit long. We did cut whole, you know, back and forth between characters, cutting 4-8 lines sometimes at a time, you know, in a scene that only has like, you know, 12 interactions, in the end. So, yeah, when it showed up at E3, we were submitting it for final, you know, around that week or the week after, and everyone who saw Amazon and saw people playing Amazon on the team said, oh man, we overdid it. We definitely overdid it. And there was a bitter regret going on there. Because, you know, there are people that didn't want to see it. And it's very hard to write something, know exactly how it's going to work, and then know that it's coming off as smoothly as that in game. And, you know, it didn't. And, yeah, that was the choice we made early on, but you know, we were given the opportunity to do an update. Capcom's like, hey, we need to do an update. We want to add, I forget what it was. I know there was a couple bugs, but they wanted to do like an update with the disc versions coming out. They said, oh, hey, oh, I think it was a PC. You know, it's been so long, I can't remember the specifics, but
but there was an update.
There was an update. We were going to do the Red Coat Scrooge too, but then there wasn't enough room in the Xbox update with the way we had all the data stored. So we would have gone over the limit on updates. So that's kind of a bummer. So we didn't get to put that in the game, but you know, there was a few other little feature updates to go in there along with bug fixing. And we said to Capcom, hey, can we do a quick cinema mode? And Capcom was really cool. They're like, yes, you can just, you know, show right up exactly what it would do. And so basically for something like the Amazon, when you pick up a coin, you don't have Scrooge stop and then talk about the coin and have interaction with Launchpad. It just goes on playing. It, you know, as a gamer, if you don't care about the story and you don't care about DuckTales, that's what you'd want to see. If you want it to be more like the NES game, that's what it's going to be. And so I regret that we didn't have it in there sooner. I regret that it wasn't in there at first pass. And
it's also for reference for people that have not developed games. It's once you submit, it's very hard to get something through that process again, because there are so many people that are submitting their games. It's not just you. So it's not like PC. It's actually a lot easier because you usually don't have to go through an approval process. It's just kind of like, I want to put something on Steam. And as long as Steam says, yes, this works, you can usually put it on. So getting through that submittal process is no trivial task. So
yeah, for console, you're submitting to the publisher has to approve it. Then it has to go to the company that's going to be publishing it on their console. As also has to go to ESRB, has to go to different ratings boards. Australia can be really slow. European ratings boards can be really slow. ESRB is probably the fastest. And
there are some too that are in other countries where it is a government function.
Yes.
For rating, so yep. that's slow as well. So.
And I think for Sony and Nintendo, it not only has to get approved by the country you're publishing in, it has to be approved by the Japanese office as well. So when you submit something to Nintendo, it gets approved in America, and it gets sent to Japan, and then Japan has to approve it also. So, and now imagine that the game isn't digital, that it's manufactured. now that approved submission has to get sent off to a disc manufacturer, and that disc has to be manufactured in a window that isn't overlapping with Guitar Hero in 2008. So that ran into that scenario personally. And, you know, then it has to get manufactured and shipped. So whenever you see a game the game's been delayed by 3 days. You know, the thing isn't, oh, well, I hope they're fixing some bugs. It's like, they're not fixing bugs. They're dealing with manufacturing or shipping issues.
Right.
So, yeah. But,
so it's in now. There you go.
But yeah, we put it in the update. So if you update the game, you'll see it. And, you know, just, chalk it up to a bit of a mistake. And if we hadn't have been submitting for a final build to release in August, you know, that week of E3, I would have pushed to put it in right away. Actually, I think I would have been submitting a couple weeks later, because I came back from E3 and one of our lead programmers is like, can we please change it? And I'm like, I want to, but we can't. It's too risky a change. I'm going to see if we can do it in an update. And so we did. And that's the thing I love about WayForward. And I've been here for 6 years now because, you know, most everyone I've worked with has cared passionately about what they work on. You know, it doesn't matter what the project is. It could be Happy Feet, it could be Barbie, and it could be someone who doesn't like DuckTales working on DuckTales, and they would still care about making the coolest thing they can, because, you know, they want to make people happy and just really enjoy their experience.
Absolutely. So
yeah.
We've got two other questions, and then I think we're going to have to call it a day. So this one is from Amimi Bo Hunter. What is that secret in Thor DS that nobody has found yet, or at least how do we find it?
I think I was just alluding to a secret that isn't really anything. When we made the game, Mark Brooks, who's an amazing Marvel artist, he did our portrait slide-in art, and he said, I probably won't be able to play the game. And I wanted him to be able to see all the portraits. And so we put in a feature to where if you enter your birthday Well, if you're playing the game on your birthday, so on the DS, you can set your birthday on the console. If you're playing Thor on your birthday, you don't have to have beaten the game. You just go into gallery and all the portraits are unlocked.
Cool.
So I was just more making fun of the fact that no one ever plays the DS on their birthday or pays attention to what they're doing on their birthday on their DS or 3DS, or they have more important things to do on their birthday. So,
yeah. Or that they would play that specific game on their birthday, perhaps.
Yeah. But they really should.
It's a solid game.
They'll see the art. It's a pretty good game. It's another game where, you know, I learned a lot more after the fact. I learned a lot about the development process. And every game after it's the better for it. But the bosses are pretty cool. I'm in agreement with, like, every single review that's out there. So.
And there was a snow level in that one, too.
There was a snow level. That was a pretty awesome level.
Yeah. Okay, so
there's a couple snow levels, actually.
This is the last question from Ken and Eldari. What are the interesting bits and complications working with existing and well-established IPs?
I think managing expectations of fans, that can be the hardest thing is, and I think anyone that's ever written a script or done a sequel or done a remake or a reboot of anything, if you're not doing something there's a big knee-jerk reaction to, oh, you did it wrong. It's like, well, I did it different than you would have done it. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong. With DuckTales, there were so many choices to what do we change? What do we keep the same? What do we change? And if people say, oh, you changed it, I'm not going to like it because you took out this thing that I liked, versus I didn't think that needed to be improved or I didn't think that needed to stay. You know, it's a bit of a guessing game at the beginning where it's like, well, I'm pretty sure if we cut this and we cut this and we add this and we add this, it will come together to a, you know, good final product. And then, you know, you hope that it does. And when it does or doesn't, you then have to, you know, course correct based off that. But the thing that's really neat is when you're working with established IPs, you know, usually they're, it sparks a lot of creativity. There's a lot of stuff to pull from. I know another director here, Adam Tierney, he loves comics. He's a huge comic nerd, so he loves getting comic games. He wrote the pitch for Thor, and his pitch was so elaborate and amazing, and it really helped inspire me on the game. But like, he loves working with IP where you can just like, oh yeah, we're gonna take this character from here and this character from here, and oh, wouldn't it be cool if this character, you know, then this character did this. He always talks about on the X-Men game he did how X-23 was this character that was underutilized. He's like, we got to put X-23 in the game, we got to put her in. And so he put X-23 in there, and so you know, he loves that he got to, you know, integrate that character into there. So working with an IP that already exists can be a lot of fun. You know, a lot of people might think it's very limiting, but, you know, you can think of it like it's Disneyland. It's like, yeah, there's walls, but everything you could want is, you know, within those walls. So,
yeah, no, I working on Batman, the Brave and the Bold was awesome for me because I'm a huge Batman fan. So when it was going through there, and the cool thing about Batman, the Brave and the Bold is he teams up with other DC comic heroes. And Adam Tierney was also the director on that one.
Yep.
And it was great because we pulled in all these different characters and we, you know, used their lore, and we got to, because we were all fans of it, I think we were able to make a better experience of it because we, you know, cared deeply about those characters. And I think there was even a Kotaku article about the writing on that one as well, saying that it was, you know, really well done. And
I think we did win an award from GameSpot for that one, and it was for the best license or writing. It was in that same category. So yeah, like Adam, you know, really did an amazing job. And I think I wrote an episode of Teen Titans recently. So that guy's a great writer and he loves comics and he just gets it. And he's really good at that. And it's funny that you say Brave and the Bold, because that, like, the comic itself and the show, like, really does pull from the lore of characters that no one's heard of in the longest time. So it was like right up his alley. It was like, you know, perfect for him. So it's pretty fun.
Just to say this as well, and then we're gonna have to call it a day, but it's the only time that I like Aquaman, actually, is in the Brave and the Bold TV show. They do a fantastic job with Aquaman because he's like
forsooth, we found it, ha ha,
you know, instead of the kind of over darkly saturated Aquaman that they put in the comics.
And then it's fun in the DS game when you get Aquaman's call in and he rides in on a whale for a full screen attack, you know? Like, that was just, it's just a lot of fun.
Yeah, for sure. So, anyway, that is all the time we have today. I really appreciate you coming on the show today, good sir. Is there anything you want to kind of promote or talk about? You just had an iPhone game that came out, right?
I personally do some iPhone stuff on my own. I did a game called Super Secret Service, which is a simple little, high score. I guess, for lack of a better term, it's like a Crossy Roads or a Flappy Bird, just play until you die kind of thing. Just a fun little thing I did on with Johan Vanette, who's an amazing pixel artist, and Flashy Goodness, who has this amazing ability to make Super Nintendo era music. So we just did this, little title, which is kind of fun. And it came out in November and got featured, which is pretty neat. So that's another game where someone, I said recently, like, I think it's a pretty good game. And someone's like, you're too close to it. It's a really good game. I'm like, oh, cool. Thanks. Just stroking my ego. But I do some stuff on the side. I'm trying to make more games for my kids because I made a garbage truck game for my son that is just like a touch screen and interactive illustration. I'm going to do some more of those because they're kind of fun to make. And, I come home at night and I don't play games as much. I've come to discover that I enjoy making games at home. It's kind of like my art these days. So I don't like drawing anymore. I don't like painting. I really like just making games. So I just can't stop. But, do want to promote Way Forward. Keep an eye out for what we have on the horizon and keep an eye out for Shantae Half Genie Hero, which sadly we didn't get to talk about too much because that game is, it was our Kickstarter last year and it's coming along really, really well. I think people are going to really like it. And it's building on kind of the groundwork of DuckTales and just taking it even further. And it looks phenomenal. We just did a little fun iOS puzzle game called Mighty Switch Force Hose It Down. It's based on like Mighty Switch Force 2 and like the tube blocks in that. And it's a neat little puzzle game on the App Store. So you should definitely check that one out. I have a lot of fun playing with it. And I hand my wife my iPhone and she won't stop playing it. So it's pretty neat.
It's a good sign.
Usually, yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'll have you back on the show again. We'll talk about it further.
That sounds amazing.
Amongst other things, because there's always lots to talk about. But so, sir, thank you so much for coming in. And thank you guys for checking out the show. If you're interested in supporting the show, check out our Patreon page and just donate $1 or something like that. Maybe I can get soundproofing so you don't have to hear trucks and or dogs barking.
Trucks are fun.
They are fun. Not on podcasts. Recording. See, sorry. Look, there's another one. Just went by. Serendipitous, perhaps. Anyway, thank you guys so much. Appreciate it. Have a good day. Austin, you rule. Thanks for coming on the show. Adios.